Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I am a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. You can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org under Public Affairs for prior programs, as well as on the WDIY app. Today is May 28, 2025. The markets were down today, with the Dow closing at 42,098, the NASDAQ at 19,100, and the S&P at 5,888. Tonight, we are talking about taxation with asset allocation, investment geography, and risk tolerance. We are live. We will take your questions. Jen is in the studio with us this evening and will answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic and I'll do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air, or if you're not comfortable talking live, just give your question to Jen and she'll write it down and bring it into the studio. If you prefer to send them through the website, you can certainly do that at yourfinancialchoices.com. We've talked in recent weeks about the elements of your financial life, and if you remember what those would be, it would be cash flow, investments, retirement, taxes, risk management, and estate planning. We talked about your story and your situation and how it's unique as your thumbprint. We talked about goal setting and building flexibility and options and using SMART goals. SMART goals being S, specific, M, measurable, A, achievable, R, relevant, and T, basically time measured. And so in the coming weeks, I thought I would dig a little bit deeper. So tonight, I thought I would review the taxation of your investments, but really focusing and concentrating primarily on understanding risk tolerance, what is it, asset allocation, and asset geography, because all of that plays into the taxation of your investments. So first, understanding risk tolerance from an investment perspective. We can look at a typical risk tolerance questionnaire or investor questionnaire, which helps an investment advisor understand your tolerance for risk, typically for a particular time horizon and your stomach for volatility. So usually if you're working with a professional, they really, I think, would perhaps be mandated to kind of go through the risk tolerance. It's how you have to document the tolerance for risk that a client or an investor would have, which helps inform what kind of investments that you're going to go into. So the time horizon is really informed by your age, your estimated life expectancy, and the withdrawal rate from the investments. And the withdrawal rate can be for, you know, short term and long term. And the age matters in answering the question, when do you plan to begin withdrawing money from the investment? So that would typically be one of those questions you would have on the risk tolerance questionnaire or investor questionnaire. When do you plan to begin withdrawing money from the investments? And once I begin withdrawing funds from my investments, I plan to spend all the funds in X number of years. Like, how long do you want the money to last? Risk tolerance, so this is kind of the broad understanding of it, and then I'll get into a little bit more details. So the risk tolerance is informed by cash needs over time. And frankly, from my perspective, it's also your emotional capacity to tolerate the noise. So what is your capacity to tolerate the noise? That's not one of the questions on the risk tolerance questionnaire, but the investment advisor, when they're talking to you, will also talk to you probably about understanding your habits. How did you react during certain periods, during certain cycles in the market, during certain news cycles, political cycles, whatever it might have been. Hopefully they're kind of getting a feel for that too, because we want to make sure that however you might score out on this questionnaire, that it seems applicable to your pattern and your habits. So when I had said that Rick's tolerance to me is also your emotional capacity to tolerate the noise, what I mean is the ability to separate, you know, data supporting the economy and the market versus information that is kind of spewed out having nothing to do with facts, but maybe gossip, noise, you know, drama, hypotheticals, the next breaking news. I refuse to have a TV in my office because it makes me crazy when it's breaking news every other 5 minutes. It's news, you know, it's news. That's they're trying to get you to stay tuned and watch. So I try not to be distracted by that. My only concern there sometimes is when we talk about, you know, the boy who cried wolf. He cried wolf, cried wolf, cried wolf, and then no one believed him after a while. So I always worry about that with the breaking news. Like sometimes it actually is breaking news. So you have to kind of stay tuned a tiny bit. You have to reflect on how you have reacted in the past to current events, worldwide events, and understand why we take risk. Why are we going through the steps of identifying what your risk tolerance is? And one of the reasons we have to kind of understand it, and which again, this is all leading to what kind of investments you have, what kind of asset allocation you have, which leads into what kind of income are the investments going to give you and what kind of taxes are you going to have on that income. So it's all kind of related. I'm trying to follow some flow here. So why would we take risk? And typically we take more risk. When we take more risk, we want to be compensated for taking that risk. So when we have to kind of measure your tolerance for it, that's why it's important to understand the timeline. And I'll give you some examples. So let's kind of put this time horizon and the risk tolerance together. For example, if you have investments of $100,000 and you retire and you need to tap those investments and you need $20,000 a year, in the next 5 years, how much risk can you take from a time horizon? Well, think about it. Just simple math. If we can remember how to do simple math, $100,000 and you need $20,000 a year for the next 5 years, that money's going to be gone in 5 years, basically. How much risk can you take with it if you need it? So the shorter the time horizon, the less risk that you could take. Now, if you have investments worth $2 million and you need to tap your investments by $20,000 a year, how much risk can you take from a time horizon? Well, $2 million at $20,000 a year is a much longer timeline. You have much a longer runway. If you take on risk and there's volatility and you lose some money in your investments, you have time to make that up. And you also have adequate resources that it wouldn't matter maybe if something's happening in the market, typical, you know, volatility, it's not going to necessarily impact the longevity of that pot of money when you're only drawing so little out of it. So we're going to talk a little bit more about risk tolerance, asset allocation, and then how that plays into the asset geography and the taxation and why that's important in factoring in all those elements of your financial life. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY's 30th anniversary All-Star Celebration is right around the corner. Join us to mark 30 years of broadcasting with live performances from the WDIY All-Stars, including Dave Fry, the Jack Adams Blues Band, Piper's Request, Tavern Tan, the Druckenmillers, DJ Big Fury, and more, all under a covered pavilion. Saturday, June 7th from 1 to 6 p.m. at South Mountain Grove in Allentown. Tickets available now at WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY. We are talking about risk tolerance, asset allocation, asset geography, and taxation. If you have questions, and it can be off topic, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live, just give your question to Jen, and she'll write it down and bring it in to me. So we are talking about the importance, I think, of understanding kind of the draw on the portfolio. So if in my examples, I set $100,000 and, you know, if someone needed 20,000 of the 100,000, that's a pretty big draw, 20%, versus my example of 2 million and with a draw of 20,000 a year, that's like 1%. Very, very different. So you don't need much money from a percentage basis from that larger portfolio. And if you haven't invested, the money might grow faster than the withdrawal. And that's why it gives your portfolio a longer life, potentially, because you're not taking much out. So therefore, you can keep more of it invested because you can withstand volatility longer in this story, I'm saying. Whereas the person who has only $100,000, who needs a bigger draw, a higher percentage, you may not be able to expose yourself to higher risk assets because you wouldn't want to have to draw from the portfolio in periods of volatility, where if the market's really down and you're having to pull 20,000 out, if your 100,000 goes to 80,000, 20% drop, and you have to take 20 out, now it would be as if you only had 60. It's harder to make that up when the next year you have to take another 20. Whereas the 2 million, they're only taking 20. They have a longer timeline. All right. So this is why you also want to understand the elements of your financial life and why it's really, really critical to build up savings where and when you can, because it gives yourself, gives you more options and flexibility in the future. So the bigger pot of money that you accumulate, and it sounds simple, sounds easy. You think, Lori, that's so silly. Why are you even saying that? Duh. Well, it's because we do see people not save enough. We do see people who come and say, hey, can I retire at 60? And they don't have enough means to support their lifestyle that they, you know, had while in their working years. So the more that you're able to accumulate at a younger age, and when you're younger, usually you're working, you have a longer timeline, you may be able to take more risk because you have a job and you expect or anticipate that you're going to have a job for quite a while and hopefully more earning power as you get older, you know, promotions, more jobs, or, you know, making more money increases, et cetera. Whereas someone who's 63, it's going to be a little bit harder for you to accumulate at that time because you're already so far, you know, down the line of a career. All right, so thinking of it sooner. The other thing I wanted to mention, many people think time horizons. When we talk about looking at your risk tolerance, I told you we look at your time horizon as part of that. Many people think time horizons are based solely on age, and it's really an element of the time horizon. For me, the draw is the bigger player. So, for example, back to my $2 million story. If I have someone who's 70 years old and they retired and they have a $2 million portfolio and they only need $20,000 a year from the portfolio because maybe they have a pension, maybe they have cash in the bank, maybe they have the Social Security, and all of those things are enough to sustain their lifestyle. They don't have a big draw. Then that is an important element of the time horizon, if you stay with me here, meaning they have the time they need that money to last, it's going to be there for them. There's a big pot of money and it's going to last longer. So when we talk about time horizon, we're usually asking when are you going to need the money and how much are you going to need the money and how long do you want it to last or you think it's going to last? I've had clients who are in their 90s who have 90% in equities because that's just how they are and they don't need it and it works out fine for them. So time horizon really plays the draw in the time horizon to me has a big role. And it also helps us understand how we fill up the buckets, because remember I said some of the questions might be, how much are you going to draw from the portfolio? When are you going to begin withdrawing funds from the investments? And how long do you want it to last? That helps us understand kind of like short-term buckets and long-term buckets. Like how much do you need in the short term? So back to my $2 million story. Let's say this person said, I need $20,000 a year for cash flow, but I also want to buy a new car and I want to make a charitable donation of $50,000. So now I'm thinking, okay, we need $20,000 a year for the next X number of years. For sure, we want to make sure that's there and available for them. And then we have $50,000 for a car. We're not sure when we're buying. It might be this year, might be next year, might be in 3 years. So we want to make sure that we have that $50,000 available for them the day they call and say, hey, I need the money for the car, found what I wanted. And then the $50,000 charity. So now we're talking about securing maybe $100,000 for the $20,000 a year cash flow for 5 years and $100,000 for the charitable giving and the car. So already we're talking about $200,000 of my $2 million that I'd want to make sure is pretty safe and available. So we would typically be looking for something a little bit more secure and more risk-free. Could be a treasury, could be, you know, some type of, could even be a money market or high yield. I'm not making any investment recommendations. I'm just saying something that would not experience the volatility that you may have if you were in the market in equities. All right. So that would be my little short-term bucket. And then I might say, well, then, you know, we want the next 5 years after that. Maybe there's something else going on. Oh, well, you're going to buy a second home, or you're going to buy a vacation property, or you're looking at a 55 plus community where you have to put in a deposit of, you know, $450,000. I might want that to be a little bit secure as well. Maybe not as secure as the $200,000, but I would have that kind of come into play in our risk and the investment objective of the overall portfolio. So once you understand the time horizon and the tolerance for risk, you can make some assumptions about how much money you're going to need for that period of time, X period of time, and then invest that portion more carefully for those shorter term needs, as I mentioned. And then this is where that asset allocation comes in. And it's usually described with objectives like growth, income with growth, growth with income, income for safety of principal. And as we move more conservatively through those descriptions, so growth would typically be, you know, equities, income with growth might be value stocks, that kind of thing. And then income or safety of principal would be, you know, a much more conservative kind of preservation type allocation. But I want to talk about that too when we get back. I want to talk about if you take no risk, I often hear people say, I don't want to lose anything. I don't want to lose anything. And I have to describe to them, you actually might lose something over time. And we've done shows on interest rate risk and inflation risk. So we'll talk about that a little bit when we get back. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY 88.1 offers many choices and real voices. Folk music, from folk classics to the Gaelic traditions of the British Isles, to bluegrass and old-time music of Appalachia, to the modern-day singer-songwriters telling the story of today's world. You'll find it all here on WDIY. Listen and enjoy the wide variety of folk music every weekday evening, 7 to 9 p.m., just after NPR News headlines, and Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. on 88.1 WDIY and streaming at WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY, also on the WDIY app. We are talking about asset allocation, risk tolerance, taxation, asset geography. And this is really piggybacking on several shows we've done recently where we've talked about the elements of your financial life, where we've talked about your story, which is your personal story. And of course, setting up goals, SMART goals, to help you kind of see where you're going and what you want to do. It's all so important and all works together. And in talking about, I want to get to the point where we kind of talk about the taxation and how that's important when we're looking at asset allocation and asset geography. And so right now we have to understand risk tolerance and what that means. So we talked about one could be aggressive or moderately aggressive. We have some other, you know, terms, and other advisors use different terms, but I'm just looking at the investor questionnaire that we use. And so typically we would go through some questions that might ask, one, when, as I mentioned, when do you plan to begin withdrawing from the investments? And, you know, could be less than 3 years, 3 to 5, blah, blah. Once I begin withdrawing, how long do you want it to last? That helps with the time horizon. Then the risk tolerance, we would ask things such as, what is your experience with investing? What amount of financial risk are you willing to take when you invest? Meaning lower than average risk. Typically, can you accept lower returns for lower risk? Or do you want to take, you know, have average risk or more risk for potentially more returns, but also potentially more losses? That's the piece that people have to remember. If you're taking more risk, then you typically could have more losses. And again, it might not be real losses if you don't sell, but it could be if you have to sell. That's why it's important to understand timelines and how much you need to withdraw and when you need to withdraw. Okay, so we can be preservation-minded, conservatively-minded, moderately conservative, moderate, or balanced, then moderately aggressive, aggressive. Again, all with different terms, but that's kind of the gist of it. And when you take on more risk, the anticipation or hope is that you're going to get higher returns. Okay, so now we have some direction for investing the total portfolio. And some people might use that allocation per account. And this is where I kind of want to dig in a little bit. So let's pretend that you have gone through this risk tolerance questionnaire. Maybe it was a free feature on your retirement account at work, or a free feature on one of the custodians that you might have heard of. Maybe they have something where you can kind of pinpoint your risk tolerance, and you say, oh, I am a moderate or I'm a balanced investor. And that might be more like when we a 60-40 allocation. And when I say 60-40, 60% equities and 40% fixed income or bonds. Within that 60% equities, it could be an array of different kinds of equities. So I'm not talking about that just yet, or probably not tonight anyway. I've done other shows on it. But the 60% would be more market exposure, and the 40% would be more kind of fixed income, a little bit invested, a little bit more conservatively. You're not going to have the same kind of returns on that. So if we have a 60-40 overall risk tolerance, now we want to say, how are we going to apply that to the accounts that we have? So now you get out a piece of paper and you say, well, what are the accounts that I have? Oh, I have, you know, $50,000 of cash in the bank. I have $200,000 in my 401k at work. I have $40,000 in a Roth IRA. And I'm making these up numbers up as I'm talking. And, oh, I'm a balanced investor. It said I'm balanced. I'm going to do 60-40. And now do you apply it to each of these accounts? Well, the bank, the cash at the bank, that's cash at the bank. It hopefully is in a high-yield savings account or a money market account. Maybe you might have it in CDs, something that's going to give you a higher interest rate than literally, you know, just the checking account rate at 0.01%. But typically when you've got the money in the bank, and we want to keep that for emergency reserves, I haven't even talked about that yet, we're not usually talking about investing that money set aside for those emergencies. So now we have $200,000 in the 401k, and let's pretend we say, okay, 60-40. We're going to do 60-40 on that. That would be $120,000 in equities, and it would be $80,000 in fixed income. And then we have the Roth IRA, and let's pretend we're going to do 60-40 on that as well. So I'm going to do $24,000 in equities and $16,000 in fixed income. We don't have an individual account at this point in my little story. So if we did balanced and we're investing that way, I think it's really, really important that people understand how your investments get taxed. Because if you're putting away money in your 401k, typically you're doing it on a pre-tax basis, meaning you're not paying taxes on that in your wages. Today, you're getting the deduction today with the concept of I'm in a higher tax rate today while I'm working than I might be when I retire. So I'm going to lower my income by putting money into a retirement account, typically a 401k or a 403b on a pre-tax basis. I don't pay tax on that today. The other side of that, though, is I don't pay tax on that today, but I will pay tax on it when I eventually take it out, when I'm retirement age and eligible to take the money out. And the goal is, oh, if I'm retired, I'm not making as much money as when I was working, and I'm going to take less out. Maybe I've paid off my mortgage, I've paid off my cars, I'm not putting kids through college anymore. So my expenses just aren't what they were when I was working, and I don't need to pull as much money out of my investments to meet the kind of cash flow needs I had while I was working. I have lower cash flow needs. But when you take money out of the 401k, it's all ordinary income taxed at ordinary income tax rates, meaning if you're in a 22% tax bracket, you're going to pay 22% on whatever you take out. You know, 100,000, you take 100,000 out, you're going to pay 22% tax. That's, well, and it's usually not that. It's an effective tax rate, not a flat tax rate. So let's just go with me and pretend for simplicity, 100,000, let's say the effective tax rate's 20%, then you would clear 80,000. All right. If you needed 100,000, you're going to have to take out more because of the taxes to net 100. But it all comes out as ordinary income, subject to ordinary income tax rates. Okay. Even though you had 60% of it in equities. Now, what is the further draw of equities? So equities, I mentioned, we take on more risk in the hope of higher returns, but there are also typically other benefits of equities when we're investing in the market in individual accounts or even in Roth IRA accounts. The incentive is there's tax-favored treatment on, well, on Roths in general, but tax-favored treatment on equities. If we hold it like in an individual account, there's something called capital gains tax rates that apply to long-term gains, appreciation, and or qualified dividends. So to have the equities in the IRA, it helped it grow, which is great, but you're not necessarily getting any income tax benefits on that. The Roth, you're going to get tax benefits regardless because you already paid tax on that money. Now you invest it, and whatever you invested in, is when you take it out, is going to come out income tax-free. We're going to talk about how this makes sense when we come back from our break. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live, just give your question to Jen and she'll write it down and bring it in. You can also submit questions through the website, yourfinancialchoices.com. I hope this is helpful to some of our listeners. And I always hope that after you've listened to a show and you're sitting down the next day or the next week or the next month and you're looking at your accounts, you start to look at them differently. It's like when you look at one of those 3D pictures and you stare at the 3D picture long enough and another image, you know, reveals itself. That's what I hope when we're talking about all these different topics each week, that at some point something is revealed to you and you have an aha moment. And hopefully to your own financial benefit. So I'm talking about the importance of understanding your risk tolerance, which factors into, you know, time horizon and your tolerance for risk, and how it's important to know then how you are going to allocate your investments. We talked about, you know, are you preservation minded? Are you aggressive? And in my story, we're balanced and we're doing 60-40, 60% equities, some, you know, array of different kinds of equities, and 40% fixed income. I said the 401k, if you now take that allocation and you apply it to each account, you may not get the full tax benefits that otherwise might be available to you. Remember when I said equities, the goal is that you're hoping for, if you're going to take more risk, that you're going to get a better return. And what did I tell you about the 401k is all ordinary income, no matter what. The Roth IRA, I said, is tax-free, no matter what, as long as, you know, qualified distribution kind of a thing. So if it's tax-free and I can get something to grow tax-free, would I not want it to grow? So if we apply the 60-40 allocation to my little story of my Roth IRA with $40,000, $24,000 would be in equities and $16,000 would be in the fixed income. So you're not going to get the same kind of growth on that that you would get in an aggressive kind of allocation. Again, this is all personal. I'm just trying to explain the income tax thinking behind our investing strategies. I personally probably would like a Roth IRA to grow, you know, pretty fast at no income tax. So now let's talk about an individual account. So we had the 401k, which is all pre-tax dollars coming out ordinary income, whether I have it in equities or bonds. And the idea of a 401k is to grow. So I'm not suggesting that you don't have equities in the 401k. I'm just suggesting that you really allocate, not necessarily based per account, but per your entire portfolio. So when I think about an individual account, so now in my story, this person has saved some extra money. Maybe they inherited some money. We have $100,000 and I can put it in my individual brokerage account. And what are my advantages there? Number one, when we talk about retirement accounts, we may not be able to tap retirement accounts because there's some handcuffs on those. Maybe I'm still working. My employer doesn't allow in-service distribution. I'm not old enough. Maybe I'm only 38 and I can't take money out of my retirement account without tax and penalty. The Roth IRA, or maybe I could take out my original contributions, but I really don't want to do that because it's growing income tax-free. And now I have this you know, $100,000 that's in my individual account. Yes, I want to get it invested. I want to get it growing. I want to make sure I also have enough money for my emergency reserves, for my immediate needs, my short-term buckets, blah, blah, blah. So our $100,000 might be allocated 60-40. It might be. That might work out very well because that 40% might be there for me to be able to tap if I need it over the next few years, in case there's market volatility. So if I have 40% of that kind of, you know, earmarked, that's $40,000, that could help go toward, you know, fixing the water heater, the air conditioning, the car, putting new tires on. And then the 60% is the equities that I hope is going to be growing. But it gives you more than that. You hope that it's growing, if you can tolerate the volatility, but it's also going to give you tax advantages because the equities, as I mentioned, have tax favored treatment. If you sell anything at a gain and you've held it longer than a year, it's long-term capital gains tax rates. And then if you get dividends on those same equities, typically the dividends are going to qualify for a lower tax rate as well. So let's talk about the tax rates. While you're working, maybe you're in a higher tax bracket. I said maybe you're in a 22% tax bracket, but it's you know, it's tiered. You know, it's like 10%, 12%, 22, 24, I think 32, 35 or something. So it's an effective tax rate, but capital gains taxes and qualified dividend taxes, they're pretty set. And to the extent you might be in a 12% bracket, and I've seen people who are, the dividends and the long-term capital gains are taxed at zero. If you are in a higher than 12% tax bracket or your income kind of, you know, goes over that, the higher, once you're past the 12% tax bracket, the qualified dividends and the long-term capital gains are taxed at 15%. So the tax rate after 12 is 22, but the capital gains and the qualified dividends would still only be 15 in that story. Zero up to the 12% bracket and 15 up till it's like 400 and some thousand for, you know, I think married filing joint. So there's a really big bracket where the capital gains and the qualified dividends are taxed at 15%. So when you're looking at that overall asset allocation, that 60-40, maybe I'm not going to do it account by account. Maybe I'm going to do it overall. So now in my story, I said I had, you know, the $50,000 in the bank. Again, I'm going to talk about that in a minute. We want to make sure that's earning something. And I have my $200 in my 401k, my $40 in my Roth, and $100 in my individual account. That's $340,000. Now, I didn't do the math on this, and I should have, 18, 19, 20. What I would do then on $340,000, I'd want about $200,000 in equities in my story of 60-40. Well, what bucket am I going to fill up first, maybe? My Roth. I might want my Roth to be more all equities because I'm not going to touch that for many, many years. It's tax-free. I want it to grow as long as possible. Only tap it if I have an emergency or if I need it. You know, again, you can always take out your original contributions. Earnings can't come out tax-free unless it's been the longer of 5 years or 58, age 59 and a half. So that Roth is usually the last thing I see a lot of people tap. And it comes in handy when people have, like, you know, little emergencies and they don't want their income to go over a certain threshold. But maybe I want like 200,000 of my 340 in equities. So I'm going to fill up my Roth bucket first. And that was 40,000. And now I have 160. Well, that I can put to equities. Well, my individual account, I said, was 100,000. So maybe I'm going to keep just 20 in fixed income and have 80 of it in equities. So of my equity sleeve, that leaves me 80,000 more. So my IRA, my 401k, I might only do 80,000. Okay. So I might do 60% fixed income in my 401k and 40% equities. Get it? But then when you add it up all together, your 60-40, just not account by account. The other thing I want to point out is that some people go into target date funds, and target date funds, that's where it says you don't have to like watch it so carefully. It kind of takes care of the asset allocation for you. But that's also based on a time horizon. So if I think I'm going to retire in 20 years and we're in 2025 and I pick a target date fund of 2045, it is going to get more conservative as I get closer to 2024 or to 2045. Remember, I said just because your age doesn't mean that should technically inform your risk tolerance. If you have $20 million, then just because in 20 years you picked a target date fund, it doesn't mean you're going to need any of that money. You might have, you know, $20 million outside of that, you know, $200,000 401k. So you want to be careful with target date funds. Just watch out for that because the target date fund will automatically rebalance to something more conservative as you get closer to that target date. So just watch out for that. That's why I you know, caution people to be a little bit careful with target date funds. So we're going to kind of allocate based on your whole portfolio. So hopefully that all makes sense. Let's see. I also wanted to make sure that we talked about those short-term funds. So remember I said we had $50,000 of cash in the bank. What that really gives people when you have your emergency reserves. And I tell you, when I started in the business, we used to say 3 months emergency reserves and have a credit card that you could use in case of an emergency. And, you know, credit card interest rates are now sometimes up to like 29%. So I really just cannot stand anybody having a balance on credit cards anymore. Like pay it off every month. And if you haven't, like make that a top priority. But you want the cash reserves in the event you have an emergency. But also, I feel it just makes such a difference for people being able to tolerate the volatility in the market. If they know they're in a pinch and something happens and they know they can grab, you know, some of the low-hanging fruit, the cash in the bank or maybe part of the fixed income that we kept in my little story in my individual account, we kept a little bit of money there. That helps people tolerate the fluctuations in the market. So emergency reserves are important. The short-term needs are important. That's why we have to ask, what do you have planned for the next 5 years? If we have clients who are going on vacation and they have the vacation of a lifetime and it's $30,000, we want to make sure that's set aside. So it's really important when you're going through this, especially if you're working with an advisor, that you kind of disclose all of those kinds of needs. Also disclose your emotions around investing, et cetera. And I also have seen where people will come in and they'll say they're aggressive and we find out they have, you know, $300,000 of cash in the bank. So, you know, you do have to kind of make sure that you're factoring in all of your emotions, all of your assets, and, you know, you're being truthful about how you feel because someone who has that much cash might not be as aggressive as they might lead you to believe. So it's really important to understand the whole picture and how all the elements of your financial life work together, your cash flow, your investments, your risk management, your estate planning, it all comes together. It's all very important to understand how all these pieces work. I'm going to talk about some more tax advantages of the equities and the non-retirement accounts other than Roth when we come back. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services, including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. There's still time for questions if you have them. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Questions can also be submitted through yourfinancialchoices.com. So talking about asset allocation, risk tolerance, asset geography, and taxation. I've already mentioned some of the pros of taxation on the investments and on the equity side. Let me just talk about a bit more. So I already mentioned that if the equities pay dividends and they're qualified dividends, the qualified dividends qualify for a lower tax rate. The capital gains tax rate could be zero, could be 15. And yes, sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, it's 20%. It's really 20% for like some of the highest earners. So for the most people, it's going to be 15% or zero. And also looking at your tax return, if you do have investments, I always say the tax return tells a story. I look to see how much interest I see on someone's tax return, and I look to see how many dividends people have on their tax return. And just because you have dividends doesn't mean they're all qualified. If you think you have dividends and you think, oh, yeah, Lori, I got those dividends, like you said, well, if you put it in a mutual fund and the mutual fund is, you know, a balanced fund or a bond fund, then you're not getting all those dividends at the favorable tax rate for qualified dividends. So you have to understand what's within the funds you're investing, if that's how you do it. You've got to look under the hood to make sure. So look at your tax return to see what kind of income you have. The other thing with the equities is there may be times where you actually could do a little tax planning and do what we call tax loss harvesting. So when we do see volatility, sometimes we might like a position and we want to keep it or keep it, holding in that sector, but it's just taken a dip at this particular time. We can actually sell it, realize the loss, and as long as we don't buy back the same investment within like 31 days, then we can take that loss. We wait 31 days, you can buy right back into it. But sometimes you don't want to sit on the sidelines with that investment that you sold, and you could go into something similar, but not so similar that the IRS won't allow us to take the loss. So you can still be in the market rather than sitting completely on the sidelines. So that's tax loss harvesting. That's another advantage of equities. And then those losses you can use against other gains in the future, or current gains, or up to $3,000 of loss against ordinary income. And that's what I really like, getting the $3,000 loss against ordinary income. Because remember, ordinary income is taxed at higher rates than dividends and long-term capital gains. Another advantage to equities is a step up in basis. So if someone passes away under current legislation, and I pretend I bought Apple stock, no, I didn't, but pretend I bought Apple stock for $10,000 and it's now worth $1 million. If I sold that during my lifetime, I would have almost $1 million gain. But if I die holding that Apple stock, it gets a step up in basis to the date of death value. So the next day I die, my kids sell the stock, or my husband sell the stock for $1 million. It has $1 million basis. There's no gain on that. That is awesome. If they inherit cash, it's just cash. Oh yeah, there's no income to, and I'm only talking about income tax here. There's no income tax on the cash, but there's actually no other, you know, real value to that either, other than the cash itself. So big tax savings on step up in basis. Big tax savings could come from tax loss harvesting. And then, as I mentioned, the tax-free Roth IRA. So to get some equities in there, you're not getting, there's no benefit necessarily for the qualified dividends or the step up in basis or long-term gains, because any transactions within the Roth IRA are not taxable, and any distributions are not taxable. So, but what you're hoping for in the Roth is the growth, the tax-free growth. So typically we want the growth from equities. That's the goal. Remember, more risk, you expect more reward, you expect higher returns with the risk that you're taking, as long as it's a risk that you can tolerate to take, and you have to understand how you kind of guess what that risk is that you can do. Now, here's another potentially tax-free vehicle, and that is education accounts. So you've heard on prior shows me talking about Section 529 education accounts. It's Section 529 stands for the Internal Revenue Code Section 529. If you put money away into a qualified education account, a 529, and you invest it, it can grow income tax-free. And if it's used for qualified education expenses, it remains income tax-free. So I'm careful about my language only because if someone takes money out of a education account and uses it for something other than qualified education expenses, then other than certain exceptions, there would be income tax on the income and earnings within the 529 and a 10% penalty. And there are some penalties if you take money out early out of a Roth, the earnings out of a Roth. Same thing with the education account. Let's pretend I invest $50,000 into an education account. It grows to $60,000. I decide my good-for-nothing kid doesn't deserve it. They're not going to go to college. I'm taking that money out, and I'm keeping it, and I'm going to buy a new car. So I take $60,000 out. Well, it was a disqualifying distribution. It wasn't used for qualified education expenses. I put in $50,000. I'm not going to pay tax on the $50,000. It grew to $60,000, so there's $10,000 of gain there. I'm going to have income tax on the $10,000 plus a 10% penalty. So now you just kind of really did yourself in. So that's not such a good concept. So you really want to make sure that when you're putting money in a qualified education account, that it's going to be used for education. And if it's not going to be used for a particular beneficiary, you can always name another related beneficiary. There are some relation rules that we have to follow. The person kind of has to be related to the original beneficiary. But that is another way to do tax-free growth. Now, the difference between the qualified education savings account investment and maybe the Roth is I might be 25 years old and saving for a Roth, and I could save for the next 40 years. Education accounts are typically going to be used for a particular time. Usually if I have a grandchild and I put money into the 529 account, we know in 18 years they're going to need that for education. It could be sooner than that because years ago they expanded what you could use a 529 for, and you could use up to $10,000 a year for tuition for private elementary or secondary schools. So you might use money from a 529 a little sooner than age 18, but there is a shorter runway quite often for education accounts than you might see for Roth. Quite often we see clients using the Roth IRAs as not only a way to save for their own retirement, but if it's kind of like that bonus pot of money that if they don't need it, they can pass it on to their children. And many, many people are driven by passing funds on to their children. And quite often I have clients who say, well, yes, I want the Roth to go to my kids. I don't want them to have to pay income tax. It's very interesting to see how parents really want to benefit their children overall. Not always, but overall, that's what we usually see. So the tax advantages, it's very important to understand that when we're talking about your risk tolerance, your asset allocation, are you looking at it account by account, or are you looking at it on your overall portfolio? And to understand the taxation of the different kinds of accounts you have, whether it's a retirement account on a pre-tax basis, 401k, 403b, you took the tax deduction basically while you're working, it's growing taxable. And Roth IRA, love Roth IRAs, great vehicle. If you can do it, do it. There is still the concept of the backdoor Roth. We've talked about that before. If you're not otherwise eligible for a Roth and you don't have any other IRA accounts, you could be a candidate to do a backdoor Roth where you do a non-deductible IRA. With a non-deductible IRA, because your income is too high, you're not allowed maybe to take a deduction for it, then it's non-deductible. And now I have basis in my IRA. And with that basis, I convert that to a Roth. And because I have basis, I don't have to pay tax on it because I've already paid tax on that money. And that's a backdoor way to fund a Roth if your income is otherwise too high to be eligible for a Roth. And, you know, for years, this was a loophole and I really didn't talk about it much because I didn't feel, you know, I thought the IRS was going to close that loophole and I didn't want my clients, you know, being hung out to dry. Well, with the Secure Act, I think they kind of affirmed it. They haven't closed the door on it. So it is available, and it typically works, though, for people who don't already have IRAs. And here's why. If, pretend, I have $100,000 in an IRA, and you heard on the radio, oh, Lori said I could do this, you know, non-deductible IRA, do this backdoor, and I'm just going to put it in a separate account. I'm going to put $7,000 into my IRA, and I'm going to convert it because I have $7,000 basis in that, you know, account B. That's not how it works. The IRS looks at your total IRA, no matter where it's held, what accounts you have. So if you have $100,000 in bank A and you put $7,000 in bank B and you think you're, well, you have basis in $7,000 in that one and you think you're going to convert it. No, the IRS says your basis is $7,000 on your total IRA of $100,000 bank A plus $7,000 bank B, $107,000. So the amount that would be not taxable because you have basis is the percentage of $7,000 over $107,000. So you really, really lose the benefit of the conversion when you have other IRA money. Now, if you're someone who only has $1,000 in an IRA, it's pretty good. You probably still could do it. But quite often when people leave a job and they roll their 401ks over, they're usually rolling them over to IRAs. So sometimes people have really big IRAs and it's not as beneficial to do the conversion. But if it's available, if you're not otherwise eligible for it, then backdoor Roth, non-deductible IRA. We've been able to do non-deductible IRAs forever. So just keep that in mind. That gives you basis. And for people who have not thought about a Roth IRA, you must not be listening to the radio show often enough because I talk about them all the time. And the Roth IRA contributions, the income isn't as high as one might think. If you're married filing joint and your income, your adjusted gross income is under $230,000, then you can fund an individual Roth IRA. Again, why I love that so much is you can always get out your original contribution, but if you don't need it and you invest it can continue to grow income tax-free. Single people, the threshold is $146,000. There's a phase out a little bit, but I'm not going to complicate the discussion with that. Married filing separate, you're really kind of out of luck. I think your income is like $0 to $10,000 is a phase out range. So you're really not a candidate for funding Roth IRAs. They give little penalties to married filing separate people. And of course, that is, you have to have earnings as well in order to fund individual IRAs, individual Roth IRAs. You have to have earnings. That is separate from a conversion. Converting an IRA to a Roth has nothing to do with wages. And also, you can have a 401k at work that offers you a Roth feature, and that is a way to plow a lot more money into a retirement account, more than what the regular individual Roth is. And you can do both. You can do the 401k and the IRA. You can have both as long as your income's within limits. And that's because they're different kinds of plans. They're governed under different sections of the Internal Revenue Code. One's an ERISA plan and the other is not an ERISA plan. I hope this was helpful tonight for some of you. Thank you, Jen, for being here. Thank you, Bridger. Next week, we have navigating various retirement accounts and features. I'll talk more in depth about some of those retirement accounts. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller within the tradition folk music. Remember, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices and have a great week.